Geekily Yoked is a proud member of the Crossover Nexus. To find more blogs and podcasts about the intersection of faith and pop culture, check out crossovernexus.com. Tell them Bilbo sent you.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekably Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast.
I wooed.
As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
I'm Cyborg Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Cyborg Rachel Kessler?
I'm a cyborg.
Yes, you are. Tell them why you're a cyborg.
I have one of those, like, bizarre 24-hour heart monitors on me.
Fun times.
So I have, like, strange EKG
tabs wires.
Like, taped to me and wires.
And a 4,500 pack that we can't get wet.
Yes. The Canadian healthcare system a lot of money.
Which is problematic when our daughter sees it and thinks it's a toy.
It's true. Mostly when I'm trying to feed her.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a process.
I can imagine.
So that's where we are. Woo!
How is your geek Fortnite?
I don't know. I have a cyborg wires attached to me.
But we went to Montreal!
We did go to Montreal.
And you wrote extensively about it.
I did on my blog. I was at a gathering for clergy from the Anglican Church of Canada under 40.
That's a specific
demographic. Yeah, it was a really specific demographic, but,
Did you guys split up by, like, blood type, or?
I mean, you and Amanda were there.
I was. I got to see beautiful Montreal.
You got to see much more Montreal than I did.
While trying to get my infant daughter to sleep.
It's true. So we got to experience the Quebecois culture a little bit.
You mean smoked meats and poutine?
Pretty much, that's, yeah.
Oh, I don't think I actually had any poutine this trip.
You didn't find the cool poutine place, it's true.
Well, you know, I was mostly trying to keep
it small. We had some good pain au chocolat.
Oh, that's very true. Our place, cafe
was nice. Quebec is kind of like Canada's European-themed wonderland.
Parts of it, yes.
Yes.
Montreal is definitely this sort of bizarre city that where all of Canada's history kind of is stored and stashed away. It's a very nice place.
It was a great conference, great gathering, feeling energized about the church and God.
These are all good things.
And our unity in Christ and mission.
No, it really was actually a beautiful thing to see. I only saw some of your various gatherings and whatnot, but I was there for the final Eucharist, and it was really just a quiet but well coherent.
Yeah, I mean, considering that very few people actually really knew each other before going.
Well, yeah, you guys were from all over, like BC to Newfoundland.
So there was actually a person from St. John's, Newfoundland, which is the furthest east in Canada.
There we go.
So there you have it.
What did I do? I watched the first disc of Lizzie Bennet Diaries today.
You did.
It's very strange, Rachel.
It's awesome. Well, like, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries is so weird because it starts out as this, like, it starts out being just, like, funny, whimsical, what if Pride and Prejudice were on YouTube?
Yeah.
Wonka, wonka, wonka. And and having watched all the special features on the DVDs now, they, like, had plotted out the first 24 episodes.
Yeah.
Which are, because they filmed them in 8-episode chunks.
Yeah.
So basically they planned the first 3 shooting days. And then it's interesting because those first 24 episodes really are the waka waka waka.
I'm going to dress up as my family.
And it gets quite dramatic. By the end of it, it's quite dramatic.
Well, it's very strange watching it on DVD.
Because so you're just watching it in all in a row very quickly?
Well, because you say, you click play and it just goes through it all, right? And I remember you watching it and it kind of, having that kind of break, having like the little like menu screen at the end.
Yeah.
Of each episode. And there was just there's sort of a rhythm to it that's different. Because it is sort of like thing to thing to thing. And also all the like the whimsical cuts are kind of jarring.
Yeah.
Because, it's like, oh, it's YouTube. Of course there are whimsical cuts. We watch a lot of Vlogbrothers. And that's how they do. Because not everyone is insane like me and does everything in one take. That's just, I'm just too lazy to edit. I'm not too lazy, apparently, though, to do 24 takes of something.
It's a different kind of lazy.
But it's...
It's like Chris, our parish administrator, yes, and I were chatting, and we were going to, like, type these table blessings,
okay,
into our church app that we're, sure, working on. And he was just like, wait, I can't scan your prayer... Because it's off my little prayer cube.
Yeah.
Oh, like, right. It's like, I can't scan this and just copy and paste it. It's like, I have to type them. Usually I scan it and then have to change it, like scan it from a PDF, and then I have to change it into Word document, and then I copy and paste it, and then I have to format it. That's so much less work than just typing them all.
Oh, you're a little prayer cube. It, yes, is very sweet. No, but it's interesting. I was showing it to my friend David, who had not seen it at all, and so was just sort of amused by, yeah, the strangeness of it, and Lydia.
Lydia, what?
Yes. What, indeed. So that's sort of been it. I don't think I've really done a whole heck of a lot. I started watching Archer again because it came on Netflix.
Oh, we actually watched season 3 of Game of Thrones.
Oh, that's right. We did.
We are only one season behind now.
Yeah. That's how we, ooh, roll.
You do not come to Geekly Yoked for timely, relevant, pop cultural reflections. You come for the banter, right? That's what we offer.
That's very true. Some other podcast was interested in having us on, but they talk about movies, and the last movie we saw in theaters was Gravity.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, didn't you go out and see one of the Hunger Games?
I never got out.
Oh, okay.
Because Amanda wouldn't take a bottle.
Oh, that's right. The baby. Always the baby.
She wouldn't take a bottle, so for the first, like, 4 months of her life, I could never leave the house for more than, like, 2 hours at a time.
It was depressing.
It was a little difficult.
So we're not going to be able to talk about X-Men or even the second part of The Hobbit or anything that's not from October 2013. But I feel like what we do talk about has been well digested over and over and over again.
But not from our perspective, which is the perspective you've been missing.
That's what I'm saying. I say what we're going to be talking about is digestive bias.
Mull and savor it.
Yes.
Right.
Which is what's going to bring us to today's topic, something that we have mulled and savored quite a bit. Space opera.
Pew, boom, pew, boom, pew, boom. Pew, 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 pew.
Rachel, what is space opera?
What is space opera? Isn't that what, like, the journey of today's episode? To attempt to define this elusive thing?
Well, it's definitely something that we have talked about and brought up and we like. But I guess the didactic way to look about this is, what is it not? Like, what will we not kind of consider space
opera? Okay, well, no, I think...
Or is that problematic for you? Is that going against, you know, what is good by defining by what is not?
Mm. Well, Meg, okay, here's a question. Is Doctor Who space opera? I'm inclined to say no.
Oh, okay. I was about to say it's. I feel like it's something that's very... Well, at times, for me, it's very character-driven.
It is.
And it's very relationship-y driven at times, I guess.
I think that's what people would argue. Classic Who, less so.
Yeah.
New Who, that's one of the criticisms from certain sectors,
mm,
that it's too soap opera-y.
Because, I mean,
Rose and the Doctor shouldn't be in love with each other.
Because, I mean, for me, I mean, if we're talking about soap operas, there's sort of a difference between episodic television and that kind of...
But I guess,
of,
I guess that, here's my question.
And
is,
operatic, because it's, yeah, it's that iconic dynamic sort of situation, right?
Well, and I wonder, is Doctor Who space opera because... Well, A, it's not always space exploration, primarily.
Yeah.
There's the time travel element to it as well.
Sure.
And it, I don't know, it doesn't have that sense of... Like, you can't have a bottle episode in Doctor Who, really.
Didn't they try that on the bus?
The bus, they had the one where the Doctor's, like, exploring. He's in, like, he's on, like, some kind of day trip on some vacation he's, yeah, having, and they're trapped. And so, I mean, like, that is kind of, but not in the sense of, like, you're in a spaceship out in space and you're, like, there's not really, you don't ever have, like, a TARDIS bottle episode.
Okay.
It doesn't have that same sense of, I mean, it has that explorer quality.
Yeah.
Definitely, but there's something about it that, like, you don't get space battles. You don't get. I mean, are space battles necessary? I don't know. But,
well,
like, you don't have.
Is space opera defined by storytelling and how the story is told, or is it design? Is it setting and tropes?
I feel like here's I guess what I would say. you don't spend a lot of time in space in Doctor Who.
Okay.
You visit planets.
Sure.
You visit places, but there's not necessarily a lot of space.
Okay. But again, I wonder if it's a question though. What, you know, where how are we looking at this? Is it the space or the opera that defines it? And opera to me is something that's dynamic. It's about characters that change over time. You know, we look at Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine is a dynamic show.
So is original Star Trek.
Well, that's the thing, right? Space opera. Because that's iconic, episodic. The characters don't change.
Yeah.
You know, they just move on to the next thing again and again and again.
So is original I would say Deep Space Nine definitely space opera.
For me, I probably original Trek and Next Generation. I don't think so. But again, I look at space opera as these clashes of personality.
No, I'm inclined to agree with you. I'm inclined to agree with you that the opera is
operative.
Operative indeed. That there has to be some element of drama driven by storytelling and character, not primarily hard science fiction space.
Yeah.
But from that, even though Doctor Who might fall in that latter category, there is something about the space side of Doctor Who that doesn't seem necessarily like, there's something that's missing.
Okay. It's certainly science fiction, right? As far as tropes, as far as what have you, that's, I think it's really solidly in that. For me, I feel like space opera really contrasts with the kind of the super hard, almost like military sci-fi or engineering sci-fi.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Because I think a lot of this comes from books, right? Which don't have quite the same kind of, like, they don't have the same issues television shows or movies have. I guess closer to movies in that you're telling kind of a contained story. But there really are, you know, those kind of either hard military sci-fis or engineering sci-fis are really exploring ideas or you know, kind of concepts. And the characters are sort of there to describe to one another what these situations are. And then as you start exploring, you know, Vorkosigan is for me what epitomizes
space opera.
You know, that's that, you know, where it
is. Well, it has
all
everything.
About, yeah.
It's, I mean, Vorkosigan has, I mean, it's space battles. There is even a military SF aspect to it with Beriar.
It's very much there, especially with the Dendari mercenaries. I mean, that's the stuff that turned you off, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I couldn't read it took me forever to get through the first few books of the Vorkosigan series because I just didn't care.
Yeah.
And it was because I didn't like the character of Miles.
No.
Early on.
You did not like Admiral Naismith.
I did not like Admiral. Yeah, I think that's fair. I liked Miles Vorkosigan. I did not like Admiral Naismith. No. For those who have not read the Vorkosigan series, Admiral Naismith is Miles Vorkosigan's alter ego.
It's sort of, his persona, so he can pursue and running a bizarre little mercenary fleet. But when he's being the crippled son of, you know, the regent on his strangely backwards militaristic planet and sort of is trapped
it's
in
a way to escape
hierarchy
out of that, yeah.
It's that, yeah. So that's, they're very, they're, you know, one is able to be brash and in charge and, you know, go in guns blazing, and one has to be subtle
and the other
and
is
political,
you know, a lieutenant and
take orders.
But then you, later on, especially as you're able to get more into Miles as, like, political maneuver and diplomat and mystery solver.
Yeah.
Investigate, what is it he, and
eventually he auditor. Essentially becomes an auditor,
Then it takes on even, like, it becomes incredibly character-driven.
Yeah.
Incredibly plot driven.
Well, it's always been relationship driven, right? You know, his relationship with his parents, his relationship with the people around him in his fleet and like in his service in weird ways.
Well, and ultimately the conflict within himself, who is he eventually going to be?
Yeah.
Throughout the first half of the series, it's this incredible tension between Miles and Naismith.
Oh yeah.
And is he going to be Miles Vorkosigan? Is he going to be Admiral Naismith?
And you know, maybe that's a question that Lois Maxwell is asking about her series. You know, do I like telling the story about this kind of backwards military planet that's struggling with reentering, you know, quote unquote modernity and in dealing with changing social norms, or do I want to tell the story about the brash young, you know, the brash young mercenary who runs around rescuing people?
Well, and what's interesting about Bujold is that she's able, through this incredibly intricate character drama, to actually deal with a lot of those more philosophical science fiction questions. I mean, she deals so much with what makes a society and how societies change over time and how they deal with death or bioethical questions, the legal status of clones and what might they be and how might different cultures respond to clones?
Well, and she's also, I mean, and this, from what I've heard from folks who spent time with her, she is very aware of sort of undermining and playing with a lot of the military sci-fi tropes, because maybe this is all in my head because...
And remember, she's a girl, so she's ruining science fiction.
She's a girl ruining science fiction. There's been a lot of sort of hoopla about Robert Heinlein, who's, you know, one of the kind of the great grandfathers of science fiction and, you know, one of these grand men, and a lot of folks kind of questioning his legacy and talking about the problems he sort of instills because he had sort of weird authoritarian bents. And, you know, if you read Starship Troopers, which I did as a kid and I thought was great, you know, if you go back and look at it, it has some really problematic politics, which is not presented problematically. It's more like it's a bit prescriptive and a bit like, wouldn't be a great idea if only people who had like military service could vote, because then, you know, it's like, yeah, that would be a great idea, because then they'd be the most invested people. Oh, I see what I've just been talking to. My oldest brother is a lot more into the crunchier mil-SF kind of stuff than I am, but he sent me a lot of it, and I've read it, and it can be really problematic. I think the worst would be a one called Freehold, which was essentially a giant libertarian like manuscript, just going nutso and not any degree of subtlety in what it was trying to suggest about how the world should be read or should be run. And Bujold is very much playing with that. I mean, she has her like her super, you know, Space Canada, right?
She's got,
you know, Beta Colony.
Oh, please. It's not even Space Canada. It's like Space Scandinavia.
But it's like, you know, this Space Canada 1989.
Sure.
You know, it's just the perfect progressive liberal paradise. And you know, they figured out all the great social issues. But there is something slightly sinister and, like, it's undermined there. And then there's the kind of the libertarian capitalist paradise where, you know, that's essentially turned into a kind of, you know, feudal crime state, which is, I think, very much poking fun at that.
Yeah.
That end. And even the mercenary stuff is really played with and shows the problems. You know, she and Martin share a lot in that, you know, they think in terms of bureaucracy and they think in terms of kind of foundational issues and how would the plumbing work here?
Yeah.
Which I really appreciate. I really like in her stuff. And it's for me, it's space opera, not only because there's ships shooting at each other with lasers, but because these characters are put through the ringer, they change over time, relationships come, relationships go, and everyone feels important, and there's allowed to be that level of change.
So maybe my issue with Doctor Who is space opera is actually not even so much the space, as I was saying before, but actually the opera.
Okay.
Because for the most part, Doctor Who is not serialized.
No.
For the most part. I mean, the Doctor changes, I think.
Well, he literally changes, like, actors, which is weird, right?
Yeah, and, which is but, kind but does he, of but does ends he up being a little bit...
change?
I mean, I think you could argue yes. I mean, the story of Christopher Eccleston, as short as his stint was, was the war survivor.
Yeah.
The survivor guilt. And Rose arguably healed him.
Okay. And Tennant definitely went through
Tennant,
a bunch of ringers.
Like, kind of went through, like, the god complex, basically. And,
what did Matt Smith go through?
I don't know. but for the most part, there's not a... I mean, Rose grew as a character. Donna grew as a character. I guess Amy and Rory grew as characters. But it's not... It doesn't... It's not primarily... New Who is definitely more character-driven than Classic Who.
Yeah.
Easily. But I don't think, fundamentally, it's not a show about... At the most, it's a show about these, you know, 1, 2, 3 characters. Not a large group that is dealing with complicated relationships among a large group of people that are growing and changing. The shocks of Doctor Who are not... Oh my goodness, I can't believe what happened to that person.
Okay.
I can't believe what that person did. I can't believe the choice they made. I can't believe where they are based on where they started.
Okay.
That's not the joy of watching Doctor Who. That's not primarily what... You're not primarily in it to be invested in the characters. You're primarily in it to see what that week's
adventure
is going to unfold.
Okay.
So maybe there are some space operatic elements to it, but I don't fundamentally think that's what it is. That's not what I enjoy about it, at any rate.
Certainly.
It's not. It doesn't fill that craving I have for that really intense, long-form narrative where people are growing and changing and dying and grieving and...
Now, did Battlestar Galactica give you that?
Well, I kind of want to hold off Battlestar Galactica to the end, because I kind of have this. I kind of want to ask the question at the end about whether Battlestar Galactica killed space opera.
Oh, okay.
Well. Because I don't think there's been any. I don't think there has been, at least not on television or really on screen, other than the Star Trek reboots. Space opera since BSG.
Okay, well,
so let's hold that off.
Okay,
till the
so
end.
we'll stay off space opera. I assumed yes.
Well, I mean to kind of start at the beginning. Let's talk Star Wars.
Okay, and again with Star Wars, we're definitely looking at, you know, we're moving away from television. We're moving closer. Well, although it's based on in a lot of ways.
It is kind of based on serials.
It's based on those sort of old pulp serials, which I want to say are entirely about iconic characters. I mean, that's the same sort of birth as superheroes,
right? Well, I mean, one could
right?
argue that Star Wars is also, I mean, that's the whole Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces thing, right? Is that Star Wars is, I mean, I know you have theories, you have your issues with that, but, I mean, you could argue that at least in its inception, it's the wizard, the princess, the warrior, the... You know, yeah. Dark Knight.
I mean, I feel like Lucas stumbled into a thesis that Joseph Campbell was thinking of making, or like, had made, and finally had a big pop cultural thing to glom onto.
Yeah,
I don't think
that George Lucas was sitting around going, "Oh, power of myth."
I think, you know, Lucas had some very definitive source materials at hand. He had Kurosawa movies,
yeah,
and he had the pulp, the sort of sci-fi pulp serials, and he. You know, slammed them together and came up with Star Wars, you know? And so, you know, the gruff kind of, you know, general has been who's trying to, you know, do the right thing. I mean, that comes from a lot of Kurosawa films.
Yeah.
The sort of the headstrong princess. I mean, Hidden Fortress, which is actually not a great movie. At least I wasn't a huge, huge fan of it when I saw it. I mean, but that's what Star Wars is based on. At least the sort of the Leia, you know, C-3PO, R2-D2, Kenobi side is very much that, you know, that's exactly it. The Hidden Fortress is the Death Star. But Luke, you know, Luke Skywalker is definitely, or, you know, Luke Starkiller, whatever he originally was, definitely comes from that more sort of like, you know, pulpy, like, golly gee, you know, like, I got my gun and my grappling hook that I'll never use but once. kind of school of storytelling. And again, I think we've gone back and forth talking about whether or not Star Wars belongs in the science fiction camp or in the fantasy camp.
Space fantasy,
you know, because, this, you know, with the issues of the Force and just the storytelling is a bit more.
Well, and we know that the elements in the later movies that tried to quantify the Force failed miserably.
Well, yes, there's definitely that. And I don't know if, you know, science fiction is aiming at something a little different.
Well, I guess. Question. Does something like space opera lend itself to being more like space fantasy than science fiction? So something like Babylon 5 is clearly more, well, I won't say clearly. There's a tension in Babylon 5. Is it military science fiction or is it space fantasy?
Well, and it's a lot of stuff, right? Because it's like, conspiracy and it's politics and there are relationships. Like,
but
there
then there's
is
also space elves and rangers.
There are space elves and rangers. I mean, these you know, descriptions are problematic and they do all sort of blur, you know, and blend. And when I was younger, I was very much, no, there's a hard line. You know, science fiction is about asking these very, you know, what would happen if humans had blah, blah, blah. Whereas fantasy is about, let's imagine a world that looks like this. And it's, you know, exploration of a setting rather than exploration of a question. And as I've sort of gotten over myself, I feel like that's less of the case. I think they're both telling stories and in different ways, and they have just different languages that they've grown up with. It was very interesting. I was following a conversation in the midst of all this hoopla about Heinlein, where a guy asked the question, what do you get out of science fiction that you wouldn't simply get out of reading a mainstream fiction from another culture?
Mm.
You know, you'd get a culture that's not your own. Like, you know, if you were to read a Nigerian crime novel or a Finnish mystery, you know, you'd get to see a different world. So there'd be an escapist element to it. But there would be, as he put it, the world building would be better because it's actually based on something that exists as opposed to someone's.
I don't buy that because part of what you get in space opera, so let's say we're saying the genre of space opera is just ends up getting boiled down to a soap opera set in space. So it's all the soap opera-y nonsense. You just are setting it in space, so it seems like it's science fiction or fantasy.
Yeah. Well, again,
I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just saying even if you boil it down to that. By virtue of it being speculative fiction of some kind, whether we want to call it science fiction or space fantasy,
mm-hmm.
it automatically puts it in a heightened world.
Okay.
So you're automatically... the audience is automatically suspending their disbelief a little bit more about what they will buy from the characters and from the story. And just it's a world that already opens up greater possibilities.
How so?
And because you're already acknowledging that there is a certain, what is it, the Henry Fielding quotations, that fiction is about the plausible impossible.
Okay. Sure.
So it's you're acknowledging that what you're seeing is on some level, according to the rules of our world, impossible. But are willing to buy it as long as it follows its own sort of internal logic.
I get it.
It is plausible on some level.
Sure.
So I think it creates new stakes. It creates new possibilities that you aren't going to get from a novel that just happens to be set in another culture. The world building is going to be different because you know the possibilities are endless and the imaginative opportunities are there and just ripe for exploring.
Although, presumably, they are bounded by a certain amount of cultural baggage.
But then that's another question. It allows us to play out our cultural baggage on an open canvas.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think it affords different narrative opportunities. And opening up the idea of space fantasy is, you know, the mysticism, the space elves, the, you know, first races... from Babylon 5.
Well, again, the you enter a sort of... With Babylon 5, you enter that kind of Arthur C. Clarkean... And I think they even probably quote it, you know, where sufficiently advanced technology just looks like magic, right?
Not necessarily, because you do have the... There is something mystical there.
Yeah.
When you have, like, stupid lore... I was not a fan of Lorien. Like, Mr. Magical Space Elf dude who's bringing... Sheridan back to life.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he might call, like, I mean, it's couched in the language of transference of energy, blah, 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 but it's pretty, like, it's...
Well,
it's,
for me, you know, for me, the show that is all about wizards but claims to be sci-fi is Fringe, but...
Well, yes, absolutely.
But Fringe, I think, is a good example of a show that is very, very science fiction-y, very relationship-y, but is in no way sort of space opera. Space opera does have, a cultural resonance that does, you know, go to the stars and has that kind of that open...
Yeah, and I think there is something, like, that is, I think what, it's that blending of the space and the opera that's so unique to this genre. Because by setting it in space, you are... opening something. You are creating this sense of exploration. You're creating this sense of wonder.
Well, in the sense
that you're just opening something up that you don't get even in something like Fringe, which I think is a great example of relationship character-driven science fiction.
Yeah.
It's still contained, right? It's still contained in this group of five people. It's contained by this five people. I don't know. I just kind of pulled that number out.
That sounds all right.
I guess it depends on who ends up, who you're counting in that inner core.
And
the doubles and the, how many timelines finally existed on that show. Anyway.
But what you're gonna you're not gonna explore another world. You're not gonna see something
new. And it's problem solving, right? It's every case is solving that problem and using science and
quote unquote.
Yes, science. But there's a grandness and an inevitable epicness to space opera because you're in space, because you're
well,
unknown world.
Well, and even Deep Space Nine, which was also contained, I mean, you could argue, did not have the same level of exploration as, you're not going to be on a new planet every week or have a new kind of science fictional encounter every week. But they did manage to you do have that sense that things can happen and that there are possibilities.
Yeah.
And they definitely, I don't know, I feel like they found that really nice
blend.
Well,
I think it's almost a metaphor, right? Being out in space is like this metaphor for being freed from the limitations of an earthbound narrative.
Yeah.
That just by virtue of being out there, by being in a place that is completely other, I kind of keep going back to this, but it opens opportunities.
Well, it's been a half an hour and you haven't mentioned the F word.
I know. Well, I kind of wanted to talk about ideas before we got into specific things.
Oh, okay.
And to prove that I can, in fact, have a conversation without talking about Farscape.
And there it is.
Well, and I think because Farscape is the example of the almost deconstruction of space opera.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, I mean, you have, in a good way. Because I kind of want to go through a little, because you start with Star Trek, whether you consider Star Trek actually space opera.
Yeah.
You have something like Star Trek, and you have a Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which comes along later, which is more about the people and about, I mean, the truly memorable moments from Star Wars are oddly people-centered.
Sure.
It's the Luke, I am your father.
Oh, yeah.
There is another, and the
funeral pyre,
exactly, and the redemption of Anakin Skywalker, right? Yeah. Like that's the moment.
Sure. It's not the Death Star blowing up.
No, it's, and even the Death Star blowing up is mostly the awesomeness of that is seen in the responses of the characters, Han and Leia sitting there watching it blow up, wondering if Luke was still on it.
Yeah.
So you have that. It's all very noble and all, and you know, that goes into, I think, Next Generation, Star Trek Next Generation, which is slightly more into that.
And we're going to be talking from our perspective. I think there's a lot that is getting skipped over
because neither of us have seen everything.
Neither of us have watched the original Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
For me, I'm thinking, I've not read the Foundation series. The Lensman is something I know of and I know really feeds into a lot of stuff, especially like the Jedi and the Green Lantern Corps and things like that. And comic books are their whole other bizarre situation. But a lot of these, I feel like we can kind of skip over, because they do fall more into the iconic, episodic, we're going to have our adventure, but, by the end of the comic or by the end of the show, we're going to go back to where we were.
I'm backtracking on myself a little bit, but I'm wondering if the genre of space opera, as we're discussing it, is itself a necessary deconstruction of the more straightforward, serialized science fiction that came before it. Because the minute you start adding in real interpersonal character drama, you have a kind of conflict that wasn't really possible in the original Star Trek.
Well, certainly with Star Trek. It's a question of TV, right? And because soap operas have existed since the dawn of television.
No, soap
right?
opera. But that idea of taking soap operatic elements, and putting them on a spaceship, I think is necessarily going to be a break from we're on a spaceship. We have order. We're a crew. We're clean. that's what Deep Space Nine added to Star Trek.
No, very much so.
Was conflict.
Oh yeah.
And the idea that the Federation might not be perfect and that there could be corruption within the Federation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I think you could have had dark settings, even dark space settings, and still have been episodic. I mean, the episodic nature is just
I'm talking about interpersonal character conflict.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that's distinct to space opera.
Well, and very different from the Spock.
Exactly.
That's
different than something being dark or dramatic. But conflict is where you're going to get change, you're going to get growth, and where you're going to get that type
No, it's
drama.
It's the conflict where it's not just going to end with a freeze frame and a backslap and oh you guys, you know.
Yeah. So my point is that's what you get. That's what you start seeing in something like, I would say, particularly if we're talking about TV, Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5.
Yeah.
And even Babylon 5 is like this, like it tried to do that, I think, but it was still a little too trapped in the characters, like the good characters needing to be good, really, really good. But you were able to get that particularly in Londo and Jakar.
No, definitely.
And they tried to do that with Garibaldi, and they couldn't quite. They still had to give him an out where he could be totally redeemed.
Yeah, that's very true.
Which frustrated me a little bit. Or at least not be fully accountable.
Right, Deep Space Nine could let Garak be as terrible as they wanted.
Yes. But then I think I think part of it is just following general TV trends. But when you get to something like Farscape,
yeah,
is when you start getting something really, really, really different.
Okay.
Where you get like kind of not just interpersonal conflict,
yeah,
but like just chaos, basically.
Well, and you have a, you know, your main character that you're supposed to kind of be following along and empathizing with, you sort of watch break down.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
still
right?
be and still be your kind of your main
point of entry character.
Yeah, but someone who's like, I'm not quite sure what's going on. I don't know where he's going to go. And they literally split him in two, and that is interesting, and that is that kind of breakdown, and that making him not necessarily an unreliable narrator, but a kind of like, should I be on this guy?
Well, and he's not. It's not fair to call him an anti-hero either, but he was for the vast majority of the series, he is reactive rather than proactive.
Okay, I think that's fair.
Right, that he is someone who is just responding to circumstance, and the whole crew of Moya. I mean, like it is they really fundamentally have no agenda.
Yeah.
As a crew, as a unit.
Yeah.
They have their own personal things that they want.
Yeah.
But as a unit, they are just kind of stuck floating around trying to do nothing other than survive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's very true.
It's a huge shift.
It reminds me, there was a fascinating little sci-fi novel I read called, I want to say, The Shipwreck of the River of Stars, which is kind of annoying. But it was essentially a ship adrift, or kind of a castaway ship story, but in space. It was essentially a spaceship's main like solar sail broke, and the crew had to figure out how to work together to solve it, and they never do because they're so embroiled in their own kind of petty issues and like kind of they're playing kind of personal power politics and it's, you know, you're just watching it and you're like, I can see how to fix this. You just need to talk to you and ignore this past grievance, but they never get there. And it ends with this ship just, you know, everyone dead aboard it, just adrift forever. And it's great because it's, you know, it's playing with that idea of like the crew working together to solve the science fiction-y problem.
Right.
You know, there was a techno babble solution just waiting to, you know, for someone to come along, and they never do. And it's completely down to the personal. You know, again, it could have been the story of, you know, an 18th century ship that's, you know, stranded on a reef and the crew not working there. But being in space, they were able to do some interesting new things with it they wouldn't, you know, do if you wanted to talk about, I don't know, whaling vessels. and that's, you know, there's something similar to that.
Yeah.
Where you've got this kind of at odds with each other crew.
And because there is no larger story, I mean, ostensibly, there is the story of John Crichton wants to go home.
Yes.
And then later on, it ostensibly becomes the story of, okay, wormholes. What's the deal with them? Let's either get away from Scorpius or let's try to, like, with Scorpius or, you know, however the story evolves.
It's not the next gen, let's explore, or the Deep Space Nine, let's win the war.
But my point is, even those things that are ostensibly what Farscape is about, like, and by at least the middle of the series, you could say the main sci-fi premise is wormholes, potential to be terrible weapons, what do you do?
Sure.
Different factions want them.
How do you solve a problem like wormholes?
How do you solve, you know, Crichton has the, well, maybe has the key to them.
Sure.
How does he resist
these
various factions? So there is, like, a genuine, by the time you get past at least the first two seasons, there is a genuine science fiction premise that you could say unifies the dramatic action of the show, or the narrative thrust. But ultimately, it's just kind of a MacGuffin. Because fundamentally, the show really is about the people. Like, I mean, Farscape is character drama that just happens to be set on a living spaceship in
Uncharted territory. It is a very episodic show in a lot of ways, because you've got these, you know, just random misadventures, and sometimes he grows a beard, and sometimes, you know, like, they're on a prison planet.
That never went well. John Crichton in a beard never ends well.
Or they, you know, they're dealing with weird plant monsters. But there was a through line that they did follow, and, like, you can, like, I feel,
well,
like,
by the third season, it becomes uber serialized.
Like, I feel like, you know, you watch it, you watch any episode of Next Generation, and you can only tell when it is season-wise based on their uniform, and you can't tell when in the season it is.
Well, and the thing about Farscape is, even when it was arguably very episodic in the first season, it's not. You go back and watch it, and you're like, this is, like, the writers were really pushing against, from what I understand of the show, the network, the Sci-Fi Channel, wanted it episodic, and they had to push very hard to even get their two-parter at the end of the first season, to push for serialization. So you can see the, like, very, very subtly, you see Crichton change very quickly in season one.
Oh,
and
you
can see him very gradually the first season really is the breaking down of John Crichton until the second season, when he's just insane. And you can see that his degeneration happening progressively through the series, through that first season. Which is why, I mean, Jeremiah Crichton is the episode that everyone kind of looks at as being the worst episode of Farscape, which is not true. It is nowhere near as bad as Taking the Stone, which is definitively the worst episode of Farscape.
Is that the weird?
Every time I do a Farscape rewatch, I go, I'm going to watch this episode. And then I go, why am I watching this episode?
I can't help you, Rachel.
But the episode in the first season when Crichton, like, has, I guess it's based on this movie Jeremiah Johnson that I have never seen, but, like, Ben Browder and the guy, one of the producers of Farscape, it was, like, their favorite movie ever, so they wanted to do I think it's a good example of why you should, like, kill your babies.
Fair enough.
Like, which is not a good thing for me to have just said. I can't even deal. But, you know, the whole writing shtick. That this is, like, an idea they wanted to do because they thought it'd be such a great premise, but the episode itself is just terrible.
Dumb beer.
But even there, even that episode has something to redeem it, which is that you see how broken Crichton has become by that point.
Yeah.
That, like, so much crap has happened to him by that point that he just loses it and flies off. And you see him, like, just grasping for anything to keep sane there. So I mean, like, even from a character perspective, that episode has something to offer. And you have the fact that Farscape is fundamentally a love story.
That is very true.
Like, you could argue that it is just, like, primarily actually the story of John and Aaron that happens to be set in space with wormholes as the ostensible sci-fi premise.
Very true.
But I mean, the growth from the beginning, like, the narrative trajectory of that show and the story that begins in the premiere episode with John telling Aaron she could be more and her running off with this strange human to where they both end up in the Peacekeeper Wars. And everything, like, in the narrative tension builds up to the, like, you know, darkness of season three.
Yeah.
Like, it is, that is the narrative arc that unites the show.
Well, if there's one thing that gets, that space opera gets attacked for, it is
allowing romance, right?
Is about, being something that's, you know, emotional or just about, you know, is something for shippers, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I'm a shipper, I've come to terms with it.
That's fair enough.
I think it was John and Aaron that made me finally just admit it.
Well, it's, and it's relationships that, that go somewhere and mean something, right? And, yeah. you know, I'm picking on Next Generation because I think Next Generation sort of tried to do things but didn't really go anywhere, right? The whole relationship with Riker and Troy, or yeah. the relationship between, I guess, Worf and Troy, or Picard and Crusher. I mean, you know, it was a different...
Geordi and Data was the love on that show. That we all know it.
That is quite true. Yeah, these things just, or, you know, if they did have love, it would be for an episode, like yeah. Data's girlfriend or Picard's random, yeah. like, you know, occasional sort of relationships. I'm going to take, before we move on to the next segment, I'm going to acknowledge, but we never watched, both Lex and Andromeda, whichever was
oh, the, yeah. The Kevin one with Sorbo Kevin Sorbo, role. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to acknowledge it because they very well might have been wonderful examples of space opera. I don't know, Lex well, looked like a really
okay, here's a show that cheapo. I did watch some of, if only in light of my, like, rabid addiction to Farscape and needing something to fill the void.
Okay.
Which was Stargate.
Right. Yeah,
which I only SG-1, and I only watched, like, the first season and then the last two seasons that had Ben Browder and Claudia Black
yes,
in them.
Yes, yes, yes.
But is that space opera?
Oh, you actually yeah. watched it.
I'm not sure, because, it, like, there is some... I mean, it went on for so long.
And they're exploring new worlds.
And they definitely and are exploring new worlds, and there is
epic
an... like there is an epic storyline, and I think the reason I was able to watch... seasons 9 and 10 is, from what I understand, it kind of wasn't necessarily a reboot, but it was definitely like
a refocus
okay. and a slight there was a different kind of a different meta plot of sorts,
okay.
like the gold, is that what the
gold, sure,
gold were still kind of there, but the Ori were like the other gods,
right, yes.
that were like
Arthur?
Yeah, it was like the Arthurian stuff. So it was like you could kind of just pick up there and follow that new storyline,
gotcha,
and it didn't
okay.
really matter if you, as long as you kind of got the premise yeah. of what the previous mythology
like
was.
Weird, yeah.
You could still
weird aliens
sort of
worship
as
god, body snatchers, yeah.
Exactly. So, and there was certainly some character. I mean, there was definitely, I think, character driven
sure.
stories. I think it kind of falls in a middle ground.
Okay.
I think it falls in a weird
and that night,
space.
As Canadian things often do.
Yeah, exactly. And offensive to everybody. But I feel like I do really need to get my hands on Stargate Atlantis.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Which would have starred Ben Browder if not for the Peacekeeper Wars.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. Which is how he got his shtick on the later seasons of SG-1. It's really sad to listen to him talking about having to, like, come in and replacing MacGyver.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, because they sort of replaced them, but then didn't, like, then sort of, like, took a step back so they could let one of the other characters sort of be more of the leader.
Well, no, he's
or something.
Still, I don't, well, it's, it, I didn't watch enough Stargate to feel strongly about this, but I don't understand why if, what's his face? Okay, so Ben Browder played Cameron Mitchell.
Okay.
Whatever MacGyver's name was.
I have no idea.
Jack?
Sure.
Anyway.
The one who's not a nerd or a woman.
Right.
Or an alien.
or a visible, the one who is not a nerd, a woman, or a visible minority.
Who is the alien?
Right. Who is the alien? Right. Anyway, he retires from Stargate.
Sure.
From the SG-1 project. And then instead of making Sam Carter the head
of
the crew, they have to, like, hire Ben Browder?
Obviously,
I don't really understand.
Obviously, these people have worked in retail, where it's not about rewarding the people who've been there longer. It's about doing an external hire from some other place.
I understand that Amanda Tapping went on maternity leave and was away for, like, the first 6 episodes of season 9. So, like, but still, it seems like she would have taken over the crew, and if they needed to bring in an extra person to round it out, you could have brought in an extra person to round it out. I don't, and so he was ostensibly the leader of the team, but then they didn't really give him much of anything to do, so I don't know.
That's very strange. Let's move away from that.
Okay.
Firefly.
Oh, but I need to watch Stargate Atlantis. It's really the point of all of that, which is for all of my whining about needing more, I just need to find an accessible form of it that I can get and not buy all of it on Amazon because it was really cheap, which is what I did with Babylon 5.
We're trying to stay away from Amazon right now.
They're the worst! Modern day slave labor! Read the exposés of what they do to the people who work in their warehouses.
This rant has been brought to you by your local businesses. I don't know.
I don't know.
Firefly.
Yes. Awesome. Yay, Firefly.
I
mean,
I think it didn't last long enough for us to see it. No, exactly.
I feel like maybe this is just me speaking from my Farscape standpoint. So you have to understand that this is the story of Rachel circa 2005 versus Rachel circa 2011. I don't know. Where I was like the biggest advocate for Firefly and when I first moved to Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was like when my first year in Toronto was like the year right after Firefly got canceled and when they were trying to get the movie. And the movie came out like...
Movie came out 2005.
Yeah. So I came to Toronto in 2004 and was here for a year. And then that next
You were definitely brown coding it up.
Oh, I was brown coding it up. And I like converted everybody.
There is photographic evidence of you at a Halloween party as Kaylee.
There is. With the rest of the Firefly crew.
Oh, yes.
Most of whom I introduced to Firefly because I did my part as a brown coat in the Center for Medieval Studies in the University of Toronto because that is the only people I knew for the first, like, 3 years I lived here.
I entered a mixed marriage.
You really did.
I'm not a brown coat.
But I saw Farscape. And I had to admit to my, like, I had to go back like 6 years later and go to my friend Dan, who had been like the mega Farscape fan.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Peacekeeper Wars and Serenity came out right around the same time as each other.
Oh, right.
And Dan was always like, fine, you guys get, you know, Farscape was better. Farscape was the real canceled show that shouldn't have been. We got our mini series. Fine, you can have your movie. And I remember I was at your parents' house after binge watching probably like 20 episodes of Farscape in like 3 days.
Sounds about right.
And I was like, Lehman, I've come to a horrible realization. I love Farscape more than Firefly.
No, it's...
I know. And then the internet just like collectively exploded.
I'm sure.
But I still love Firefly. Yes. I feel like so much of what Firefly gets credited for doing, Farscape did before.
Ah, the old Babylon 5, Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Like, you know, that idea of bringing, you know, showing toilets in space. You know, you see Malcolm's toilet. And having, like, you know, a crew that is as much defined by their own individual agendas as they are by any kind of
mission,
and that's just trying to get by, and that's trying to just float under the radar of an authoritarian regime. And
oh yeah,
so I kind of the captain who is not like necessarily a hero who's just trying to survive. I kind of feel like maybe Joss Whedon maybe stole some stuff from Fire. Borrowed.
Was allowed himself to be influenced
maybe.
By...
Maybe. Who knows? But,
okay, fair enough. And I think it's fair to say, knowing what we know about Buffy, I mean, I think if we take from Buffy and Angel and extrapolate
that and apply
that to where Firefly would probably have gone...
And I think... And I'm a little unfair in saying that.
Yeah.
Because I think both of these shows are just reflecting a general trend in television, which was more towards the irreverent, more towards the slightly sarcastic, more towards deconstructing the absolutes of 90s TV.
Sure.
The 90s do-gooder shows that we should do a whole episode on 90s do-gooder shows.
Yeah, we could. We might have. I don't know.
I don't think we have. But it's... So I think part of it's just they're reflecting a similar trend.
Sure.
I feel like I should say more about Firefly than what more can you say than it was Firefly? It's great. It is the same thing, right? It's totally character-based drama. And I think Firefly has one of the best pilots I can think of because it's like you watch this and in the first like 30 minutes, you know who all these people are and you know exactly how they relate to each other. Like it's a brilliant piece of characterization.
I think that's very true.
The first episode, that like two-parter Serenity, is I think one of the best like bits of just characterization.
Which is why Fox didn't air it or aired
it. Yeah, didn't thought it was too slow or too. But no, I think it's fantastic, and it's not just characterization, but also world building.
Yes,
you understand like difference between the Alliance and the border planets. You understand that there are people like Badger who are sort of opportunistically working the system, and you realize by the end of it that okay, these guys aren't smuggling some kind of like incredibly precious treasure or gold bars or something like that. It's actually just food.
Food, yeah.
And this is a world where food and just the basic necessities of life are the highest prized cargo that you can be smuggling, mm-hmm. and it's that needed.
Yeah.
But it's also, like, on the one hand, it's so needed by these people on the rim, as they say, but also it's such an authoritarian regime that they would face harsh penalties
just for
having, like, Alliance-branded products.
Sure.
So, I don't know. Great piece of work. Bravo.
There we go.
BSG.
There we are. Let's have it. Let's look at this killer.
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I don't know. Like, when I say did it kill space opera, I don't really have anything to back that up, necessarily.
Well, it's just the fact that we haven't seen a big, epic, long-form, dynamic science fiction.
And I'm wondering, is that because, I mean, does that narrative require some degree of optimism? And, because, okay, take Farscape, for example.
Sure.
Because I can always bring it back to Farscape.
I know.
Even, okay, arguably the entire trajectory of Farscape is John Crichton's destruction as a human being.
Okay, yes. Sometimes into rubies.
Sometimes into rubies. But, I mean, he is broken down.
Yes.
And by the end of the show, he is basically not completely destroyed solely due to his love for Aaron.
Yes.
And yet in that, even in that, there is still the tension of he never loses his wonder at the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the opening credits do such a great job. The season three, you know, tension of, you know, hiding from the nightmares he's seen versus, you know, if... Oh, now I'm like, what are the actual words of the opening? you know, Earth is not prepared for the nightmares I've seen, but then you'll never know the wonders I've seen.
Sure.
Right? And that... John Crichton never loses that, and Farscape never loses that. As dark as it gets, it never loses its own sense of delight.
Well, and it's a Henson show, right?
It is a Henson show,
and it's Australia, and it, like, you know, just it has there is a slightly fun and yeah, there's
and that. I think if this show is primarily a romance, there's something that's optimistic and hopeful in that, right?
Yeah,
there is something that, like, two people who just, despite everything they go through, and despite all the horrible things that are done to them and that they do to each other,
there's something to be said for
love each other, you know, like, so much, and cannot.
Tragedies are the recognition of the inevitability of death, whereas comedies are the recognition of, like, the optimism that life goes on.
Yeah.
That's why they end in weddings and
yeah,
births.
Exactly. And so there is a fundamental hope there, and I think you see that in something like Deep Space Nine, which ends with that Arthurian idea of Sisko's return.
Yeah.
And Babylon 5, which is about, like, this idea of, you know, has this sense of humanity extending into millennia.
Yeah.
In some form. And then you get into, like, something like Babylon or
BSG,
and it's just, it gets very dark, and there is a kind of nihilism.
Well, I mean, BSG is probably the most September 11th television show.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right.
I mean, you know, I haven't seen Homeland, so I can't speak to, or 24 to speak to, like, the sort of just that kind of terrorism angst. But Battlestar Galactica, I feel, you know, very space opera in that, you know, you've literally got spaceships going pew, pew, pew. You've got characters, well, you've got characters that are nominally changing over time. I'm going to talk about
that. I feel like they circle back. How many times do Lee and, like, do Adama and Lee have their
Irish father-son music?
Have their, like, oh, we fight and we have angst, but we love each other.
Well, and also, my big rant for that show is that they would have a huge episode that totally, like, changes a character's perspective or, like, shines a light and lets you know something important about a character, and then the very next episode, that person would be not changed at all. Like, again, that could have, that episode could have taken place before the big changing episode, and you wouldn't have noticed. And I guess, Deep Space Nine did that sometimes, but I feel not as badly, not as egregiously. By the time Ron Moore got to Battlestar Galactica, I should have known better.
Oh yeah, we haven't discussed all of our things that Ron Moore stole. Did first on Deep Space Nine.
Well, things that he saw in like the prep rooms for Babylon 5, they then took to Deep Space Nine and then ran with further on Battlestar Galactica. But I mean, it doesn't have that wide open frontier exploration.
It's desperation, right? It's an exploration that comes out of despair, not an exploration that comes out of optimism.
No, precisely. And it is, you know, it is incredibly character driven in terms of the relationships of Adama to Roslyn to Baltar to the Cylons themselves and their relationships. And that way, I feel like it does have, you know, that dynamic quality, that way things change, that, you know, at first the Cylons seem to be this very unified front and they seem to all, like, you know, be on message, but then you very quickly realize, oh no, there's bizarre kind of fractions taking place. Fractiousness. I don't know, by the end, everyone just felt exhausted.
Yeah.
Like, by the end of it, like, I feel that, you know, it ended on a whimper, right? And then had, for me, a very disappointing final episode. In some ways, it definitely hits our criteria of the dynamic, long-form storytelling, you know, sci-fi show. But it doesn't have that wide-open nature that you get from a Farscape or even a Next Generation. You know, it's not an exploration show. So I think it's not necessarily fair to slam it on that. I don't know. It and Lost have come to, like,
I feel like It and Lost just, they are, I don't know.
They raise questions that you're really interested in. And then by the time they answer it, you're like, oh really? That was it? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And you've moved on to like three other questions.
I feel like other shows have moved beyond, like, We have a lot of serialized TV on right now, and I feel like other shows learned from the mistakes of
I think that's very true, and that, you know, that's great. You know, they set stuff up, and you know, when Battlestar Galactica was on, it was on.
Oh my goodness!
You know, like, now, admittedly, it, you know, when it was off, but you know, I loved the stuff on, I keep calling it Battlestar Eractica, but what was their new planet? Was that New Caprica?
Yeah.
Like, I love that stuff because
liked Lee in the fat suit.
I love Lee in a fat suit. I love everyone's beards and mustaches. Which I'm not ashamed of at all. But I thought that was interesting because you were seeing these same characters, but A, there was a huge time jump, which is always cool and really risky. Even Martin shied away. George R. R. Martin shied away from that with his plans for
Dance
with Dragons. They did a big time jump. They sort of married people together, interestingly, and like, I don't know. It was really gutsy, and I really liked it. And they did an occupation episode, you know, like whole arc.
Yeah.
And again, they really squished all this stuff together, and you got back to just looking for water. So there was a lot in it that really, you know, I jumped on board and was excited about, but it was certainly pushing very different buttons than the other television we've talked about or the books that we've talked about. And I'm sure that there are probably other book series out there that besides for Kosikans. I apologize that we don't talk about other books because, well, I don't read anymore because I'm a baby.
I don't read.
So the fact is we haven't really had a long form. Space?
Captain Worf show.
That's a myth.
The Captain Worf show is going to happen.
That's not
gonna, I believe in
no,
it.
No, that's not going to be a thing.
The Farscape movie is happening. Apparently, multiple news sources have confirmed that a Farscape movie is happening. It has not actually been written yet, so it probably isn't happening for like 5 or 10 years, but it's happening.
Guardians of the Galaxy might be the thing.
Really?
Because that's like, that's Marvel in space.
Apparently Nathan... Oh! Hi, Rachel, you're calling me now.
And we are back.
Are we? I don't even know what you're talking about.
We were finishing up our conversation about space opera.
It's like 2 days later, people. Welcome to the delightful world that is Geekily Yoked, where we are nothing if not professional.
Anyway.
I like to think it's part of our
we
charm.
We are wonderful like that. I was just talking that about how Guardians of the Galaxy, the new Marvel movie, might, it's sort of fun space romp.
Did I make the point about how Nathan Fillion is supposed to be in it?
I think you were about to.
Nathan Fillion's supposed to be in it.
So there we go.
Woo!
It's got its bona fides. So, like, what, In the ideal world, aside from there just being more Farscape, what kind of space opera would you like to see next? What in terms of like a big long form narrative would you like? Would you want to see another sort of Star Trek? Captain Worf aside.
Well, I mean, as long as it's character driven, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my only deal with Star Trek is I like things that are more character driven, which Star Trek isn't necessarily.
No. I mean, there is the Clone Wars animated series, and that was going on for a while. But from what little I've seen of it, I mean, I guess there's a certain...
I mean, I think something along the lines of a Firefly or a Farscape, right? Okay. I mean, something that has a bit of humor, something that has action, adventure...
High stakes, high drama?
Except they weren't necessarily high stakes, high drama. I mean, I guess Farscape by the end, but the high stakes was largely personal.
High personal stakes?
I mean, that, like, just fun, adventure. I mean, that's what I like about that stuff, is that it's human drama, but it's also... Or alien drama. Personhood. Is personhood restricted to humanity? That is a philosophical question we could address at some point.
I suppose.
Just something that is not too dour, and that's not... I don't know where I was going with that, but... Yeah, adventure.
Not that,
fun,
not that Battlestar
excitement.
Galactica, yeah, sort of nihilistic.
Not necessarily, not nihilistic, but
that
has
a
vague optimism to it, that has fun characters. And I think what space does is it just sets that in a heightened world where you know that things are just going to be a bit more imaginative.
And Muppety.
Well, it doesn't have to. I mean, we have discussed that Muppets are infinitely superior, but it doesn't have to be Muppety.
I just want my Tough Voyaging, the animated series.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, are we going to talk about Tough Voyaging on this podcast? Because we hadn't yet.
We hadn't talked about Tough Voyaging because, I don't know, it was written...
George R. R. Martin's sci-fi novel, for those of you who are not aware.
And it's a sci-fi novel that's taken from a series of serialized short stories. And so they are more episodic. I mean...
But there's still a through line.
There's a through line.
And I mean, it is character driven in that you love Tough so much.
That's very true, but each adventure is really just like, here's a problem, and Tuff sort of solves it. I don't really know if Tuff changes that much.
No, he doesn't.
Throughout it, and his relationship with Molly Toon kind of changes, but I mean, I don't know. That's why I would love to see that world played with.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting thing. I like, I think it's a great book, but it's, I do think it's, I think it's closer to that harder engineering science fiction of, here's a problem, how do we solve it?
Yeah.
The Molly Toon stuff is a lot more interpersonal. Like, that's more like, how do I relate to my planet, mm-hmm. and how do I, like, solve this problem while being true to myself and, like, not just being a sort of monster.
Yeah.
Because thinking back through all the other sort of sci-fi I've read, it is, just so much of it is just like, here's a problem. How do we solve it with technobabble or with, you know, sort of bad science? But I think it would make an amazing animated series. And
there we go.
That's where I'm going to end things off. Given that we're on a sort of a sci-fi bent, I figured what more appropriate song to end with than Debs and Errol's At in the Snow?
Pew, pew, pew.
Pew, 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 indeed. So, from the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order. Oh, I need to take a quick moment, actually, to interrupt this. To say that Rachel just appeared on the Crossover Nexus' second episode. For those who don't know, our little umbrella organization that we're a part of, the Crossover Nexus, has been having these roundtable podcasts. I was on the first one a few weeks back, which was all about adaptations of Bible stories and narratives. Rachel just was on one about monsters!
Roar!
So we'll post a link to that as well, and it's pretty awesome. So, once again, the world of faith, family, and fandom, never in any particular order, sometimes not even recorded on the same day. This is Geekly Oaked. Geek out, y'all.
Pew, pew, pew.
They measure 22.5 meters tall. Attacked Echo Base, causing it to fall. Having heavy Durasteel armament, demoralizing that the rebels lament. AT-AT's in the snow.
In the snow.
They're super awesome. They have lasers and blasters.
Pew, 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 pew.
Making rebellion squashing so much faster. Everyone you can suppress, unless they hide in a dense forest. AT-ATs in the snow.
In the snow. Ba,
ba, ba, ba. When your foes see an AT-AT, they lose hope. Impervious to laser fire, their defenses cannot cope. But really all they need is some rope. You would think if you saw these things, you'd attack their back. But they did a frontal assault and they got whacked. And so the rebels fled for space as Imperial walkers wrecked their base. AT-ATs in the snow.
In the snow.
They're not too fast, only 60 clicks per hour. Compact fusion drive system, they take a lot of power. They have a high center of gravity and a weak spot in their underbelly. AT-ATs in the snow.
In the snow.
Pew, pew, pew.
In the snow.
Pew, pew, pew.
In the snow.
Pew, pew, pew.
In the snow.
Pew.